Good day and welcome to the National Foundation for American Policy release of new study on H-1B visas. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. And please note today's call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Stuart Anderson. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Yes, this is Stuart Anderson, Executive Director of the National Foundation for American Policy, a nonpartisan public policy research organization. The report we're releasing today on H-1B visas can be found on our website at www.nfap.com, and I would like to thank the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation for their support for the research. Relatively little attention has been paid to how the new Senate immigration bill would significantly change America's policy on employment-based immigration. While the bill contains several positive measures on employer-sponsored green cards, as well as an entrepreneur visa, the legislation would also attempt through a variety of means to discourage or in some cases prohibit the use of H-1B temporary visas. The new H-1B restrictions in the bill include applying attestations on recruitment and non-displacement to all companies, attestations which may force individual employers to defend hundreds of personnel decisions each year. In addition, the bill requires H-1B visa holders to be paid much higher wages than comparable U.S. professionals, in some cases about $10,000 to $18,000 more a year. It places an eventual ban on petitioning for foreign nationals on companies with a high percentage of their workforce on H-1B visas. It would limit or even prohibit foreign nationals from working on client sites in some parts of the bill, and it removes virtually all existing restrictions on the Department of Labor's investigative authority as the means to enforce these and other provisions. A separate analysis on our website discusses some of the Senate measures in more depth. Then to summarize the study we're talking about today, the report examines a great deal of data and economic research and finds the premises on which the new restrictions proposed in the Senate bill and elsewhere are based, they're really not supported by the data or the research. First, rather than harming U.S. workers or the U.S. economy, there is substantial research on the benefits of admitting H-1B visa holders. Economists Giovanni Perry, Kevin Shi, and Chad Sparber found H-1B visa holders contributed, quote, between 10 and 25% of the aggregate productivity growth that took place in the United States from 1990 to 2010. And they also concluded that an increase in foreign STEM workers of 1% of total employment increased the wage of native college-educated workers, both STEM and non-STEM, over the period 1990 to 2000 by 4 to 6%. Similarly, economist Madeline Zavodny found each additional 100 approved H-1B workers were associated with an additional 183 jobs among U.S. natives. A paper on patents by economists William Kerr and William Lincoln concluded a 10% growth in H-1B admissions correlates with an 8% growth in Indian invention relative to firms outside the computer sector that didn't use many H-1Bs. For U.S. students, according to the National Science Foundation, a large proportion of the approximately $4 billion in H-1B fees employers have paid since 1999 have gone toward funding over 63,000 scholarships for U.S. students in STEM fields. Second, as noted earlier, the Senate bill would artificially inflate the minimum required wage paid to H-1B visa holders, but there are several serious studies that show H-1B visa holders are already paid at least as much as U.S. workers with similar experience. The Government Accountability Office in 2011 found the median salary for H-1B visa holders aged 20 to 39 was $80,000 compared to $75,000 for U.S. workers in electrical and electronics engineering, and found this was basically the same case as well in systems analysis and programming. Other studies, including one by University of Maryland economists Sunil Mithas and Henry C. Lucas, and another one by economists Magnum Lofstrom and Joseph Hayes with the Public Policy Institute of California, found H-1B professionals earn the same or more than their native counterparts with similar experience and do not harm the prospects of U.S.-born workers. A third premise of the restrictions in the Senate bill that we've heard from at least one U.S. senator is that India-based companies use up most of the yearly H-1B allotment. I think that characterization is to justify restrictions on certain companies and more generally to reduce political support for the category. I tracked the use of visas by companies over time and found between FY 2006 and 2011, the top 25 India-based companies utilized between 6% and 15% of the new H-1B visas approved for initial employment each year and 19.9% in FY 2012. In 2012, the 26,865 new H-1B visas approved for the top 25 India-based companies came to only 0.017% of the U.S. labor force. Some of these numbers would go up a bit if you included some U.S. companies with significant operations in India, but the general point is the same. Fourth, some argue that H-1Bs are not highly educated, but data from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services finds education levels for new H-1B visa holders are quite high, with 58% of them having earned a master's degree or higher. Fifth, it is argued that much more government oversight is needed of H-1B visas, but interestingly, I found that virtually no one involved in the debate seems aware that in FY 2010 and 2011, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services conducted approximately 30,000 on-site audits of employers of H-1B visa holders. At least one company reported it was the subject of 100 audits in a year, even though no compliance problems had been found in the previous 99 visits. Interestingly, despite all the audits, in FY 2010, only 1% of the audit visits resulted in referral for a fraud investigation. In conclusion, the premises on which new restrictions have been proposed for H-1B visas do not stand up to scrutiny, nor does the premise that employers should simply be able to use the generous green card provisions in the Senate bill to take care of all their employment needs. Many foreign nationals that would contribute to company competitiveness or innovation may not fit within the exemptions from the green card quota needed to sponsor individuals to start work right away without needing an H-1B visa. Moreover, a reasonable political point is that none of us knows how many of the green card provisions in the Senate bill will survive the legislative process, particularly once the House of Representatives has its say. I would close by saying if elected officials are not careful, they could be making a very serious policy mistake that would end up shifting much more work and more investment and resources outside of the United States. Thank you. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce Robert Hoffman, who is the Vice President of Government Relations at the Information Technology Industry Council, a trade association of approximately 50 leading global high-tech companies. Robert has a distinguished career that includes working for two major technology companies and for two United States senators. Robert?
Thank you, Stuart, and thanks for the opportunity to talk briefly about the report and about how it fits in the current immigration discussion that we're all in the middle of. As always, Stuart provides a great deal of thoughtfulness and great timing. We are very early in the legislative process. With the Senate, obviously, the Senate Gang of Eight bill is now out and being reviewed. The markup is scheduled for next week, I expect it will be a very animated and interesting discussion and amendment process, as it should be. It's just a very important topic and very important piece of legislation. So Stuart's report is particularly well-timed. It's also, as always, well-researched, providing some great context to take a step back. So that way we can not be governed by perceptions, but by important statistical information that is before us. And I think that's important because one of the things that we're hoping to do is make sure that there are no unintended consequences in this legislation. Right now, we have an immigration system that is rife with unintended consequences, and that's simply because most of the provisions were written at a time where no one could anticipate the kind of economy and the kind of role that innovation has played in our economy currently today. No one in 1990 could nowhere near predict the kind of economy that we're experiencing today and how important innovation and highly skilled professionals around the globe contribute to that economy. The way that we at ITI are looking at this legislation is pretty simple. You know, our goal is to have a bill and have a policy that maximizes skilled jobs that are created and work performed in the United States. And it's through that lens that we hope to influence the legislative process. The findings in Stuart's report, I think, will help guide policymakers to look at the current legislation and any suggestions to improve it, particularly as it pertains to the H-1B visa, and I'll get there in a moment. I do want to say that the reforms that have been proposed with respect to permanent residency and the fundamental policy goal to try to encourage increased permanent residency for highly skilled professionals, particularly those that are going through our college and university system, is a policy that we applaud and support and hope that it will wind its way through the legislative process intact. We also strongly believe that, you know, with the reforms in the green card process are important and may reduce the use of the H-1B as a path to permanent residency. We at ITI believe that the H-1B and other non-immigrant professional visas are still necessary in order to get to one of the important goals, which is to maximize work in the United States, particularly work that advances the U.S. as a hub for innovation. The global economy necessitates the need for companies to have talent deployed throughout the world to develop, produce, maintain, and sell goods and services. Most of our member companies, if not all of our member companies, most of the markets that they sell to are outside of the United States. So having that global supply chain for product development and for selling goods and services becomes particularly important. And maintaining the U.S. as a central hub in these global supply chains necessitates the need for temporary visas like the H-1B visa. It enables companies to deploy skilled professionals to the U.S. on temporary projects that work to advance U.S. competitiveness in the U.S. economy, such as building advanced manufacturing facilities or a shared services center that manages information systems from a central location. As Dean Garfield said before the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Immigration, you know, just like baseball players and fashion models, not every skilled professional who works and contributes to the U.S. economy needs to stay here permanently. You know, as Stuart points out, you know, arbitrary and excessive restrictions on the availability and use of the H-1B visa can disrupt the global supply chain and work against the U.S. economy. We have seen, unfortunately, a number of examples of unintended consequences. For example, we all know the story in 2007 when the annual allotment of H-1B visas was exhausted in a matter of hours. Microsoft was forced to expand its product development capabilities and create jobs in Vancouver, Canada. In 2009, when there were an increase in H-1B restrictions that were trying to be imposed administratively, a number of companies opted to move jobs as well to Canada. And again, last year, again, due to limited availability of H-1B visas, Facebook had to expand in Dublin, Ireland in order to house the engineers that they planned to have work in the U.S. So obviously, you know, skilled immigration reform is not just about filling and creating jobs. That is obviously very centrally important. But we need to take a step back and ask, you know, what is the future role of our economy in an increasingly competitive and innovative global economy? And rather than legislate in response to anecdotes and perceptions of business models, Congress needs to carefully consider how green cards and the H-1B visa and the L visa together maximize the amount of work and jobs created in the United States, and how restrictions on both can have the effect of moving work and jobs to other countries. And Stewart's report provides some useful data to help Congress carefully examine these very important questions. And it's our hope that through reports like Stewart's, through ideas on ways that we can advance the legislation and reduce unintended consequences, we can really have a immigration reform bill that truly aligns immigration policy with our goal to maximize jobs created and work performed in the United States. Again, Stuart, thank you for the time to talk about your report and how it fits in the immigration debate that's unfolding.
Thank you, Robert. Next, we'll hear from Lyndon Melman, a partner with Barry Appleman and Leiden. Lyndon has experience working on key immigration reform issues, both as a counsel to Senator John Cornyn on the Senate's Immigration Subcommittee and as chief counsel of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Lyndon?
Thanks, Stuart, and good afternoon, everyone. I've been watching this issue for a number of years, and I'm going to share a few thoughts based both upon my experience today as an immigration practitioner at a law firm that helps companies move employees all over the world, but also share some thoughts from the government perspective and my time as chief counsel at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. I would like to echo Robert's compliments that in an area that is as emotional as immigration reform and in particular in the area of high-skilled and H-1B workers where anecdotes tend to drive the conversation. It's very welcome to see reports like Stewart's that push the dialogue further forward, and I believe will make policymaking better and more realistic as Congress discusses this issue. The first point that I wanted to emphasize, which both Stewart and Robert mentioned, is the fact that right now under current law we have kind of a crazy immigration system that forces someone who graduates, a foreign student who graduates from a U.S. university, they are in essence forced to move on to an H-1B visa even if their intention is to remain permanently in the United States. And there have been policy and legislative proposals around for a number of years to change that process, and we see that reflected in the current Senate bill. And I think they should really be applauded for streamlining the immigration system, whether you call it stapling a green card to those graduates or just fast-tracking them. I think they should be recognized for a significant improvement in a very archaic legal process. But I think we also have to recognize that as a practical matter, not all companies and certainly not all of our clients always hire foreign nationals directly out of U.S. universities. And to give some real-world examples, the two that jump to mind most are one when a company hires someone from another company, a lateral hire, who is being sought for their particular skills or expertise. There are going to be many situations where that foreign employee is here in the United States, perhaps on another temporary visa like an L-1 visa or an E-visa. And those individuals are not going to be on a green card. They're going to be in the United States temporarily. And we do not want to put any roadblocks in front of the U.S. company being able to hire a lateral transfer. And for many of our clients who, because of their business, only hire people with a number of years of experience, that pipeline is critical to their continued success. The other scenario that we see as a practical matter coming up is when there are corporate acquisitions. And it's certainly many experts out there who can talk about the rapid changes in Silicon Valley and the number of acquisitions and the frequency of acquisitions. And in those settings, the H-1B visa is a critical tool to allow foreign workers at the target company to be able to move to the acquiring company quickly and seamlessly without jeopardizing both their immigration status and their green card process. And so as we look at making changes, again, to fast-track graduates of U.S. universities, it's imperative that we not forget other business models and hiring practices and their reliance on the H-1B visa. The other issue that we are looking at carefully in the current Senate bill, I think Robert used the term unintended consequences, and for me, I look at the workability of the provisions. You could have a very well-intentioned provision, but in practice, it often does not work for companies, and it may not even work for the government. And a key issue here that we're looking at is uncertainty that is brought into the process because of the provisions. And to use one of the Senate provisions as an example is a provision that would require companies that hire H-1B workers to offer the job to a better, an equally or better qualified U.S. worker, which is, of course, a very well-intentioned provision. I think there's certainly a desire by any U.S. company to hire the best possible worker for any position, and we should encourage that as a policy matter. But what we're going to be looking at in the specifics of the bill and as it moves forward through the legislative process is how that provision would be implemented and how it would work in practice. Who's going to be the decision maker on whether a worker is better qualified? Is the company in the best position to make that decision? Is the government in the best position to make that decision? At what time will that be made? What are going to be the documentary requirements? Those are all questions that I think inject a lot of uncertainty into the hiring process. And for many companies, uncertainty could discourage them from hiring a foreign worker and slowing down the hiring process. From the government's perspective, an enforcement provision like that where you're looking at who is a better qualified U.S. worker can be a difficult decision for the government to make and a very difficult issue to enforce in practice. And in my experience as a government official, what you often saw was that the companies who are the most careful and therefore, to use the term, most compliant company, are probably going to be the ones who are most concerned about a provision like that and don't want to go anywhere near that line, and they might be discouraged from hiring foreign workers, whereas the companies who might be more aggressive and push the envelope, this provision may not scare them as much. And so you might see some provisions, enforcement provisions, which do not have the perhaps intended effect that the drafters would like to see, and are perhaps not really giving the government the tools that they need to be able to run a compliant H-1B program. So again, I think that comes back to a question of whether provisions which are well-intentioned are drafted in a way that are workable both for U.S. companies who are trying to comply with the law and for the government that's trying to enforce it. So with that, Stuart, I'll turn it back to you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Lyndon. Now we'd like to open up for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, it is star, then 1 to ask a question. We'll take our first question from Aziz Hanifa with India Abroad. Please go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Stuart. Thanks for the great report, and also Robert and everyone else can have a jab at this question. While y'all yourselves and everyone seems to have appreciated the fact that STEM graduates probably should have sort of a green card stable to their graduation certificate, it seems like the whole H-1 debate, remarks by the likes of Durbin, Grassley, and others seems to be politically driven. But on the other hand, what's wrong with the multimillion-dollar companies like Infosys, Wipro, TCS, etc., being charged a much higher rate for these visas, and also having some sort of a proportional system where there aren't a much higher number of foreign workers as compared to U.S. workers? Isn't sort of a balance necessary? And how do you compromise on this?
Robert, do you want to start?
I think those are very good questions that I expect will, those are all very good questions that I think they're going to have to be addressed as the bill moves forward. And I think that really for this and all the other provisions, this kind of goes back to some of the fundamentals. And I think that the hope is that Stewart's report is the first of many that will take a step back and, answer very fundamental questions, and that is, what is the economic impact, of immigration reform proposals, whether they be in the green card or the H-1B space? Obviously, the verdict with respect to the permanent residency provisions is very positive. I think there's bipartisan agreement that we need a much more streamlined green card system. We need to incentivize companies that bring in foreign talent, to incentivize them to sponsor them for green cards. The economic evidence is overwhelming. A lot of it highlighted by Stuart in previous reports, and also by organizations like Partnership for New American Economy, that shows the relationship between giving people green cards, particularly advanced degree green card holders, and job creation in the United States is a positive one. Stuart has done some prior reports that show a similar relationship between the numbers of H-1Bs and jobs created, and I believe Dr. Zabodny, who Stuart cites several times in his report, has shown a similar co-relationship between an increase in H-1Bs and an increase in jobs. I think there was another report that showed a similar increase in H-1Bs is associated with an increase in patents awarded in the United States. So I think that, basically what is needed is, less anecdotes, more analysis of what the impact of some of these measures are. So that we know eyes wide open what's being proposed. No question that there are, that that the fundamental policy of trying to encourage permanent residency is one that we strongly support at ITI. And we also obviously strongly support making sure that the H-1B system, to Lyndon's point, mechanically works in such a way that it maximizes jobs created and work performed in the United States. So I think that, the hope is that we'll have more the kind of analysis that that we've seen from Stuart and others that will contribute to a constructive debate. And let me just stress, just as an aside really quickly, if I may, analysis that stands up to scrutiny, and this is where I give Stuart a lot of points here, because he's one of the more careful, thoughtful policy analysts in Washington. You want a report, you want statistics that stand up to scrutiny. I say that only because, last week we got a report from the Economic Policy Institute which said that the STEM skills gap in this country is a myth. And obviously that kind of analysis did not stand up to scrutiny in 2007 when several of the same authors of the Economic Policy Institute report tried to make the same argument in a 2007 report. And to his credit, Stuart was one of the people that highlighted how that report couldn't stand up to scrutiny. And fortunately, again, I'm surprised that they would make another run at this. This most recent report from the Economic Policy Institute isn't standing up to minimal scrutiny. So I think fundamentally our hope is that we continue to have the kind of reasoned debate that will allow for an immigration system that balances the various economic arguments and advances the United States economy and advances companies that are operating in the United States.
Aziz, one thing I would just add, and it's not really addressed as much in this paper, but we had previously had attorneys look at the issue of potential GATS violation under U.S. for U.S. trade commitments, and it looks like several of the provisions in the bill, some of the ones you've alluded to, may very well violate GATS, which the way it would work is that if a tribunal, World Trade Organization tribunal, does rule against the U.S., the U.S. would either have to change those parts of legislation, or other U.S. companies would potentially face tariff sanctions, et cetera, that are authorized by WTO. So that's something that could play out eventually, and I'm surprised that the authors of the legislation didn't really seem concerned at all about potential GATS violations in the Senate bill.
Just a quick follow-up, Stuart, and others. One of the problems that guys like Durbin and Grassley continually allude to is that there is some fraud perpetrated by the likes of Wipro, Infosys, and some of the other major blue-chip companies. In fact, Chuck Schumer had alluded to this too. Is this anecdotal, or is this being hyped up or exaggerated, or is there an argument for that?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, and Lyndon could chime in on what the law is, but, as I understand the law, if you have been found to be a willful violator, you're not allowed to petition for any more H-1B or L-1 visas. So if it was the case that any of the companies had been shown to have willfully violated the law, they wouldn't even be in the debate because they, at least for a period of years, they wouldn't be allowed to petition for any. Lyndon, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, I can't speak directly to the specific comments of Senator Schumer or Durbin, but I can speak to the fact that the H-1B program in particular is, I would say, one of, if not the most heavily regulated visa programs of the entire immigration system. An employer and the employee must run the trap at the Department of Labor, the Department of Homeland Security, personal interview at the Department of State at the consulate, and then an interview at the U.S. airport. And then, of course, an after-the-fact site inspection where they interview the employees and often the managers here in the United States. And that's in addition to just the obligations and paperwork obligations of the U.S. businesses. So to the extent there is abuse in the system, I do feel fairly confident in our government officials and executive branch in their legal authorities today and opportunities to go after fraud and abuse. And so I think this is an area, again, where the comments and conversations and references to what's going on, perhaps we could find more room and more space for reports like Stewart's, where we can look at the overall data and statistics in the programs and base our policy decisions off those.
Can we move next question?
Once again, it is star one to ask a question. We'll take our next question from Greg Siskin with Visa Law. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. My question is for Lyndon, and I write a lot, Lyndon, you know, about the healthcare industry in particular, and I wanted to ask, because you were talking about some of the new requirements that are in the bill, particularly about recruiting. As you know, a pretty substantial number of the physicians that train in the United States, usually somewhere between 25 and 30%, are here on visas. Some are on J visas, and a lot are on H-1B visas. I'm concerned that the language that's in the bill that has the 30-day recruiting requirement will not work for America's teaching hospitals, which use something called the National Residency Match Program, where there's a highly regulated and very structured process for recruiting physicians that from medical schools to train, and it seems like the requirement to be equally or better that somebody can challenge an H-1B based on being equally or better qualified could really throw a monkey wrench into the entire teaching hospital structure for residents around the country. And I don't know, I know there was an exception for healthcare for determining H-1B dependents, but I just was wondering if you had comments about that issue and whether there are other industries as well that are going to face challenges because of the inflexibility of the language.
Well, thanks. I think that's a very good question, and what it really brings out is what Greg's talking about is the recruiting provisions that would impose new obligations on all employers to have a very structured recruiting process before you can hire an H-1B worker. And then after the fact, the need to be able to defend that hiring decision to the government. And both aspects of that, what I would call sort of both the front-end advertising and recruiting obligation and then the back-end defense of the hiring decision, any time the government steps in and tries to dictate how those procedures run, you're always at risk that it's not going to line up with the real-world practices. And I think the one that you give is a very good example. And I can say that there's a lot of employers in a lot of industries who are looking at that and saying, that's not how our hiring process and recruiting process actually works. You know, how will this work if we're doing on-campus recruiting and we look at it or discover a candidate through that process, or we talk to two different people at that on-campus recruiting process? How are we then going to put that into the front-end tracking that the Department of Labor considers? Some of it I can only surmise is just a difference in how applications are received in views of the government versus in the private sector. The government tends to have a very regulated hiring process, whereas our clients, and I presume, Greg, your clients as well, you see a wide variety of how people identify and hire candidates, and you want to keep some of that flexibility there for the business. So I think that does just reinforce the point that, again, I don't think the requirement to post an advertisement for 30 days on an internet website has any bad intentions. I think it's a good idea to put out information and be as transparent as possible, but to do so in a way that doesn't impede or slow down the natural hiring process is where I think we need to get the bill to before it passes.
Okay, next question.
And once again, it is star one to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to allow questions to queue. We have no further questions at this time.
If I could just ask Robert and Lyndon to comment Again, on this issue of, you know, what if someone does not fit into the green card category? In other words, you know, what are the situations where an employer is just, and also to allude on, you know, not where it's not either appropriate from the employee or the employer perspective, and some of the expenses, particularly when you get into for smaller employers, if it was viewed that really what legislation is trying to do is funnel most or all hires into the green card process.
This is Robert. I'll go ahead. I mean, there are obviously a number of instances where an H-1B would be the logical choice. You know, one example obviously is, you know, all of my member companies are global companies, and they have, you know, development centers around the world in order to maintain, 24/7, 365 operability. So that way products and services are being developed, sold, and maintained wherever the sun is shining. And that's, a general rule of thumb that the IT industry has maintained for quite some time. So you have a lot of the talent deployed around the world, but going back to my earlier point, you know, if you want to have the United States maintain itself as a hub for innovation and be a central focus of innovation, there's going to be instances where you're going to want to bring your talent, you know, to the United States for further management, you know, training over a longer period of time. You may have talent that is deployed to work in a development center in another part of the world. You might need to bring that person in to work on a specific, you know, software project, that may take, several years, and you want to bring the software team together. That person may not want to be on a green card, but may want to just go back to where he or she was living prior to the assignment in the United States. That would necessitate an H-1B. You might be wanting to develop an IT-enabled manufacturing facility in the United States, but the best person to manage that project might be based, somewhere in Russia or Japan. So, you want to bring that person on to help build that manufacturing facility for that specific project. Again, that would it would make sense to bring that person either on an H-1B or an L, depending upon that person's specialized knowledge or whether they're bringing managerial or executive experience to the project. So those are just a few examples where temporary visas play a vital role in the U.S. economy, advance U.S. competitiveness, advance the United States as a central hub for innovation, and where, just by matter of circumstances, the best approach there is an H-1B or an L.
Lyndon, did you have anything to add to that?
I think Robert hit the high points. I could tell you as an immigration lawyer that in many circumstances, the H-1B will be the only appropriate visa classification to move someone into the United States. It could be that, again, because of an acquisition or a lateral hire, you have someone with the key skill sets that you need in the United States on short notice. That individual's, if they're outside the United States, is not going to qualify for an L-1 visa or any other visa. And, of course, the idea that you would have, as an employer and as an individual, represent that you intend to reside permanently in the United States to be able to get a green card. And that process, no matter how fast we make it, that process is going to be a 3 to 6 month process to get a green card. I think you're going to create situations where if you take away the H-1B as an option, you're going to create situations where either that person will not be able to come to the United States for a period of time, or they will have to make a difficult personal and professional choice on whether they want to come to the United States on a green card. And I could see many of those individuals being discouraged from taking that option and staying overseas. And I think right now, any impediment to being able to bring that person that a U.S. company has hired, impeding their ability to bring them to the United States, I think will be a disservice to the U.S. economy.
Thank you, Lyndon. Are there any other questions?
We do have another question. Okay. It comes from Ken Steer with The Financialist. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question is, comes from a generalist and someone who has not been steeped in this issue for more than the last day or so. But I was struck by, I think it was Robert's comment about the 2007 quota being filled within hours, and the fact that Microsoft soon afterwards set up an office in Vancouver. Just wondering if there is, you know, clear evidence that those were linked. And also, from what I understand, this current year's, I mean, earlier this or in April, the quota was oversubscribed within days, I think maybe within a week. So how does that suggest that there might be even more investment overseas still? And then just more broadly, over time, just how inadequate has the H-1B visa been? I mean, quantify it in various ways, but and what would be an appropriate level currently, given the you know, the key role that innovation plays in the current economy?
This is Robert. I'll just make a quick point on your first and your last question, then I'll let Stuart talk about the macro challenges of the H-1B. He's the most well-versed on that than I. But with respect to the Microsoft situation in 2007, that was a factor that Microsoft cited, the factor being the quick exhaustion of H-1Bs in 2007. Was a major factor in them expanding their presence in Vancouver, it being a relatively short drive from Redmond, Washington. So they've cited it. In fact, Microsoft's General Counsel, Brad Smith, noted that the example just as recently as a few weeks ago when he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. So that's obviously a big factor. You know, in terms of, you know, what's the appropriate, you know, level, I think that the Gang of Eight bill, by establishing a new floor of 110, but I think just as important, establishing a market adjustment mechanism. We think that the mechanism needs some refinement. There's a bill that we supported called the Immigration Innovation Act that was introduced by Senators Hatch and Klobuchar. The adjustment mechanism in that bill that would essentially let the H-1B levels rise and fall with demand, but no higher than 180,000 in the case of the Gang of Eight bill, and the increase would be no more than 10,000 in any one year. But the adjustment mechanism in the I-Square bill is one that we would prefer over the one that's currently in the Gang of Eight bill. But I think the fundamentals of having a higher cap and having the H-1B adjust with demand is an important development for immigration policy, and it's one we support. Sir, I'll let you talk about the macro.
Sure. Thanks, Robert. Well, essentially, there's been the 65,000 cap, and then in 2004, an extra 20,000 were added if you had a master's or above from a U.S. university. But from 2004 up through now FY 2014, which doesn't actually begin until October, the quota, both those quotas have been used every single year. So what that means in a practical sense is in some cases 15 months or 18 months even could go by from the time when someone would potentially be able to start working in the United States, unless in some cases they might have graduated from U.S. university and might have been able to fit into the what's called OPT to start working. But otherwise, you have really, you know, a very long period of time before someone might be able to start working. And that has obviously ramifications whether for companies deciding and individuals, do they want to wait? Are they going to hire the person anyway? Are they going to hire but place them outside the United States and then more resources flow with those types of hires? So that's really been the fundamental issue. And I think Robert's right. I think the bill does, you know, add more numbers and I think I think it brings it a little more in line with demand. But just to give you an idea, that the bill would add only about, at least in the initial stage, only about the same number of H-1B visas that were sent in for applications in the first week in the most recent April 1st opening of the visa category for new applications. So there is quite a bit of demand because of just how important technology is throughout the economy, and you know it's unlikely that that's you know that that type of demand is going to change anytime soon. Do we have any other questions?
It appears we have no further questions at this time.
Great. Well, thank you, Robert and Lyndon, and for everyone else on the call for participating. Thank you.